Well, so before I go any further, I should acknowledge our awesome staff who who were probably very panicked as that first slide came up. Kelly Mantel that just came up to phone a friend and tell me I had the wrong presentation is the Vice President for Advocacy and Communications for our team, and so she leads our strategic initiatives. Tess and Deb are on her team. Tess Benham heads up our prescription painkiller advocacy work, and Deb Trombley heads up our transportation initiatives. And so very, very glad to have you all here, and they are largely responsible for the content that you're going to be seeing today. Let me tell you a little bit about the National Safety Council. Some of you may be familiar with the council. How about a show of hands? How many people know about the National Safety Council? Okay, great. So your engagement with the National Safety Council was through what, workplace or transportation? You can shout it out. We have a small group here. Let's be interactive. Workplaces or transportation? Any other things? Yes? Great. So a lot of people have come through the council to get to know us through their workplaces. The council was founded over 100 years ago right here on Michigan Avenue in Chicago. We were founded by business leaders who said we can do a better job of taking care of our employees in their workplaces. And I'll tell you, transportation was one of the most dangerous industries around 100 years ago. In fact, more people lost their lives on the railroads, building the railroads and railroading, than died in their sleep. So we had a very dangerous industry. And certainly with the advent of automobiles, cars, and trucks, we saw a lot of challenges there as well. But the National Safety Council was really formed by leaders in the workplace safety movement who said, we can do a better job protecting our employees. And this was well before we had OSHA or the Department of Transportation. And they took best practices, they investigated what was going on in their companies, and they got those out to try to really raise the level of safety for everyone. And so today we still remain a workplace-based organization. We have 13,000 member companies who have employees at over 50,000 sites around the world. And we are able to help them raise the level of their safety program. So a lot of our founding members were actually transportation companies, and we still have a transportation division. So what are we interested in at the National Safety Council? I just thought I'd share with you an overview slide that really looks at the three peaks that we have focused some of our attention on. They're going to be all too familiar to many of the people in this room. The first peak, the red line, represents motor vehicle fatalities, and as you can see, there's a spike in the early years. Teen driving is one of our safety initiatives. Now, the good news is we've had so much success in this area, even though that number remains way too high. We've reduced it by about 50% over the last several decades with interventions like graduated driver's licenses. And by the way, the House is debating a bill on the floor this week. They're starting tomorrow about lowering the driving age for commercial drivers. So when we talk about transportation safety, that's another area out there that kind of we're connecting those two dots between young drivers and those fatalities. The second peak is what I'm actually going to spend a lot of time talking to you about this morning, and that has to do with what CDC refers to as poisonings, but the majority of those are made up by prescription painkiller overdoses. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And that last blue peak is falls, and this is, again, when we're looking at unintentional death, which is the fourth cause of death in the United States. We still, 100 years later after we've been created, we still know how to stop these deaths. We know what causes them. We know how to address them. Bella talked a little bit about alcohol-impaired driving. We know how to address that issue. Alcohol is dose-dependent. Why do we still have 10,000 fatalities last year, 10,000 fatalities this year? We're going to have 10,000 fatalities next year. We absolutely know how to address this issue, but it continues to happen. So one of the things that I'm going to share with you this morning is really a historical perspective when we look at what CDC refers to as poisoning deaths. So I'm going to run you through the decades here. First is 1963, and interesting here because before I came to the National Safety Council, when I thought about poisonings, I actually thought about the Mr. Yuck campaigns and the poison control centers with little kids drinking things that they found under the sink or in the garage. And that's where a lot of attention was placed on poisonings. So you can see that peak in the early years with very small children with accidental poisoning deaths. 73, we actually see some progress being made with that very young child issue with respect to poisonings, and the green line stays pretty flat. In 83, we are doing, again, we're still doing a lot better when it comes to those poisonings of young children, and the line's pretty much the same. But look what happens in 93. As folks who pay attention to data, there's clearly something going on here, and I'll tell you, I think a lot of people were asleep at the wheel, because I don't think that enough conversation was had about this issue until just recently. Some of you may have seen the piece on 60 Minutes last night on heroin, but you know what? I don't feel like we talked about this issue much. And Mary Pat, I was the board member on scene on the Costco Busan. We did not have a real full conversation about his use of opioids and narcotics. And at the time, of course, we talked about some of those issues, but just understanding how many people are taking these drugs, I don't think I got that. I certainly didn't until Tess started to educate me on this issue. Look what happens in 2003. We have a real problem on our hands, but we're still not able to turn this chart around. And here's where we are today in 2013. So 50 years of data is showing us that we have an issue that we need to pay attention to. So what are we doing about it? The National Safety Council has been focused on this issue since about the last 4 years, Tess, and so 4 or 5 years. And so we have been building up the work that we are doing in this area, publishing white papers to focus on specific issues. One of the things that we have a multi-pronged campaign really to deal with the medical community, and we're working through some issues related to the medical community. We're also, and Sherry, it's nice to see you, we're also working on the community level to help people in their homes and communities to address this issue. And then the third prong of this is really in workplace. And so that's, again, where our bread and butter is. We have a lot of access there. And so in addition to strengthening prescription drug monitoring programs, shutting down pill mills, affecting state legislation to help with the distribution of naloxone and promulgation of Good Samaritan laws, we are focusing on how to get employers to pay attention to this issue, to change behavior in their workplace, which will then translate to that behavior coming home with people. So another thing that Bella mentioned was our aging population, and I think it's really important when you look at this chart, you look how wide that spread is. Initially, that bump is when we looked in the 1990s, that's when the drug companies started marketing opioids as the Cadillac of pain treatment, and they had very great success with this effort, and you're seeing that bump really affect the baby boomers, and the bump does move, but look how wide it's getting. You're seeing teens into senior citizens being affected by these drugs, and this is just the overdoses. This isn't all the other people who are affected on that continuum that Mary Pat, you know, talks about, from being totally unconscious to being ready to go, and we're seeing a lot more people be impaired. So when we look at what's going on, just sharing some data, looking at what has been done in roadside surveys, about 22% of drivers in roadside surveys tested positive for at least one drug that could affect safety. That involves both illegal and legal drugs. And then 10% of daytime drivers tested positive for at least one medication that could affect their safety. And so really important to understand that we're seeing a lot of impairment out on our roadways, and how we talk about impairment has to change. Absolutely, we understand alcohol impairment, but there's a lot of other things that are going on. We see many of our companies, our member companies, coming to us, asking us for advice on how to deal with things like marijuana when state laws are changing and access is changing. But we see one of the biggest issues is what people get from their physicians legally and that's prescribed to them. And I know, Mary Pat and your team, you've looked at a lot of different things, and sometimes it's innocuous things like cold medicine that can affect people's performance, but we see real concern in other areas. National Safety Council has done a number of polls. Earlier this year, we did a survey on perceptions about opioid medications specifically. We talked to more than 1,000 people from around the country. A large percentage of the respondents acknowledged participating in an activity that is considered unsafe while they were taking opioid medications. 39% went to work. 35% drove a car. And we all know when that bottle says, do not operate heavy machinery when you're taking this medication, means don't drive a car, that's heavy machinery. And then 14% operated heavy machinery, things like forklifts or dump trucks, things that really, cranes, that could really result in harm to self or others. And so it's telling us that people, to some extent, are very comfortable with the medications that they're taking, and they're not aware of their impairment, or they're not acknowledging it. Users between the ages of 18 and 34 were significantly more likely to go to work, drive a car, or operate heavy machinery while under the influence of opioids than those who are 50 or older. And you know, one interesting fact that I took away from this survey was that people don't even understand what they're taking. We were taking this survey to understand what people knew about opioids. 29% of the respondents acknowledged that they had been prescribed or taken an opioid in the past 3 years. But later in the survey, we asked them a question. We read off brand names, Percocet, Vicodin, OxyContin. Guess what? 13% more people acknowledged taking opioids when we gave them the brand names. They didn't even understand that the drugs that they were taking were an opioid. So how can we expect the public to know what's dangerous and what's not when they don't even understand what they're taking? So the data is confusing. Many things can cause impairment. We know that prescription drugs, over-the-counter drugs, people don't widely understand what impairs their ability to be successful in the workplace and particularly in transportation. We know that one thing that can help us, that helped us with alcohol, was a breathalyzer. So how do we know when someone's impaired? Do we just take their word for it? How do we address that? And it's interesting, Bella, I think in your presentation you brought up the 68 recommendation on the impairment, which was the NTSB's first recommendation on impairment. That involved a wrong-way driver in California that hit a bus. That driver was actually well above today's legal limit. He was probably at 0.15 back in the day. And it was interesting because in the NTSB report back from 1968, as a society, we were in a very different place about what constitutes impairment. And they didn't even call the driver drunk. They said because he could read street signs and actually drive the car and navigate, you know, perform functions that were consistent with driving, that he wasn't drunk. Well, today we would know anybody who's driving the wrong way on an interstate is drunk. But we have had to change our perceptions of what that means. We've actually had to do things that require us as a society to acknowledge what constitutes impairment. I will say, I think a breathalyzer and roadside testing was a huge game changer for us. We were able to talk about it. We were able to talk about it in ways about thresholds and what the cutoff levels were, whether they're right or wrong. And, you know, I absolutely think the impairment begins with the first drink. So 0.08 is probably not the right number for us. But it allows us to at least have agreement on what constitutes a 0.08 level. Breathalyzer was a huge game changer for us. What do we need to do to get to a point where we can address what constitutes impairment involving drugs? Can we do something at the roadside? What do you guys think? Yes. Why do you say yes? And you raised your hand, so thank you. Well, it certainly, I think, is very cultural. You mentioned, you know, it's not just rural communities. I think any community in the United States, there's a very different perception. And I heard a story that helped to kind of bring this home. There was a hockey player who was arrested for DUI. How uncommon is that? Almost all of our celebrities and our sports stars, whether they test positive for drugs or whether they're getting arrested for DUI, this happens. And what do we do as a society? How do people feel about it? How do we treat the people who had these things happen to them? I mean, is there kind of an attitude of boys will be boys? Thank God nobody got hurt, but, you know, that's kind of the way they roll. That's how, you know, they live hard, they work hard, they party hard. Well, guess what? This hockey player, he wasn't from the United States. He was from a country in Scandinavia. And you know what the attitude of the people in Scandinavia was about this hockey player who got a DUI? They were mortified. They were so embarrassed. They could not believe that somebody would be that irresponsible to do that. Because for many of them, their legal limit is zero or 0.02, which is really almost nothing. It's just not accepted. As a society, it's not accepted, and people don't look the other way. There's a lot of shame that comes along with the choices that people make. Culturally, we're just not there. And I'd say distracted driving, texting behind the wheel, there's an awful lot of other things. As a society, we're just not there yet. But you know what? We can get there. Things absolutely can change. You all know this better than anybody. The public health movement is responsible for a lot of changes. Whether it's vaccines or smoking. I'll tell you, I went into a high school and I talked to some kids in a driving class about distraction and texting and cell phone use and things like that. And I asked them, I said, where's the smoking section here at your high school? And guess what? They all looked at me like I had two heads. And they all were like, there is no smoking section at our school. Are you crazy? You're not allowed to smoke at school. Well, guess what? I'm not that old, but in the high school that I grew up in, we actually had a place for smokers to take smoke breaks. There was a little section outside that was the smoking section. We changed attitudes. Today, if someone tried to light up in our office building, there would be lots of reports, right, Deb? Tess? We would not be allowing that. There would be all sorts of interventions taking place. But you know what? That wasn't very uncommon not too long ago. I worked on the Hill, and there was a congressman who used to smoke cigars walking down the hall. And I know that seems like a long time ago, but I'm not that old. So we absolutely can do more when it comes to this issue to help the public get into the right place about what's going on. The National Safety Council commented on SAMHSA's rulemaking and efforts on oral fluid testing. When we talk about a roadside test for drugs, I think we can get to that point. And my hope is once we look at this issue with respect to oral fluid testing, to be able to get a quick sample and evaluation. Yes, you'll probably have to go take a further test to do a confirmatory, but you know what? It's going to give us a really quick sign. And guess what those oral fluid tests catch? They catch opioids, and there's a lot more that we can do when it comes to this issue. So I think for sure you all are key in changing those attitudes and behaviors. I absolutely believe it can be done. But for us at the National Safety Council, we're working on changing those behaviors one employer, one person, one community at a time. We're working on workplaces. We have a free toolkit. Any of you can download it if you're interested in seeing it. Tess worked very hard with a group of experts to develop this test. We've got to develop the toolkit. We've got information in there for people establishing drug policies in your workplace, how to update those, not just for the illegal drugs that people were worried about years ago, but go beyond that. We've got guidance in there for how to address this as an employee benefit. How do you deal with this as a health issue, as a counseling issue, making sure that you provide the proper support to employees. We've got 5-minute safety talks. We've got posters. We've got a lot of information to help people. I came to the NSC last May, and in June we were going to release the kit. One of the things that I asked the team before releasing the kit, I said, do we do all the things that we're asking other people to do? And one of the things that we didn't do was pre-employment and for-cause testing. We weren't picking up opioids in those tests. I had just been hired about a month before, and so I had already been to Quest Diagnostics and given my sample before I could get employed, and so I knew we did testing. We did drug testing. So I asked our HR team to find out how much it would cost to go from the typical 6-panel test to pick up the opioids, and guess what I found? They came back and said it will cost us no additional money, no cost to go from a 6-panel to a 12-panel. So we were able to add 6 opioids into the testing regime. So I would absolutely say when it comes to employers, there's lots of ways to address this, and I know the transportation team, and I don't want to steal anybody else's talking points, but there are a lot of things that in the transportation community that people can and are doing. Some of it's mandatory, but some of it's voluntary and going above and beyond, so we'll look forward to having a conversation about those. And then the last thing I'd close on is Bella was great in calling out, don't forget about alcohol. Yes, we're talking about drugs in this session, but don't forget about alcohol. But I'll tell you, when the NTSB released that report on additional interventions, obviously the 0.05 got a lot of attention. But one of the things that they did do is they recommended that NHTSA create a standardized levels for what constitutes impairment with respect to all sorts of drugs, because the states have a patchwork system right now. And many of them, once they get the positive on alcohol, because it's expensive to test, they don't go beyond that because they've already got the positive on alcohol. So the states that did test for both alcohol and drugs in those fatal accidents, 50% of the tests that were positive for alcohol came back positive for drugs. So 50% of the people that were tested, because a lot of them aren't tested, but 50% that were tested, they had both alcohol and drugs in their system. So it tells us that we've got to deal with not just one issue, but we've got to deal with multiple issues and how they affect each other. And so when we talk about studies that show that marijuana is not impairing, just think about what people are doing when they're smoking marijuana. They're probably not just smoking marijuana. They might be drinking too. So how do we deal with those issues? Thank you all very much, and I look forward to questions.